This is a YUN interview with Ambassador Harlan Cleveland on April the 22nd, 1990, at Arden House in Harriman, New York. The interviewer is Sutherland. So, Ambassador Cleveland, I first want to thank you again for participating in this Yale University United Nations Oral History Project. And I thought if we could, we would begin this part of your conversation today on the subject of the election of Secretary General U Thant. You at that point, I believe, were the head of the International Organization Department in the State Department, yeah, is that correct?
Assistant Secretary for
Assistant Secretary
International Organization Affairs.
International Organization Affairs. And could you describe what happened on the American side after the death, the sudden and unexpected death of Hammarskjöld? What thoughts were put together in terms of a replacement?
Well, what I don't recall is the full slate, I must say. I was awakened in the middle of the night with the news about Hammarskjöld, and with a summons to a very early breakfast in the not in Adelaide's Waldorf apartment, but in another suite in the same in towers there, where Rusk was. And so we got together there for Adelaide Stevenson, Dean Rusk, and myself. And, I don't recall who else was present, but it's almost certain that Francis Plimpton and Charlie Yost were. Maybe somebody else from the State Department, but I can't remember. And we began immediately to cast about and came out, as I recall, with three people on a slate, one of whom was U Thant, but he was sort of the least preferred on the general theory that he would tend to be very third worldish and would cater to the developing country majority. And also would tend to be a Burmese passive, which is the opposite of what the Swedish activism that Dag Hammarskjöld represented. I may have the chronology wrong, but I believe there was a Finn named Max something. Who was that?
He came later.
There
was a Finn at this point. His name was Ralph Enkel, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
A Finn, and then the Tunisian Mongi Slim,
and
Frederick Boland of Ireland. They were all candidates at the time, or people had thought of them.
Yeah, but the it rather rapidly developed that the Soviet list was quite different from ours, except that U Thant turned up on their list too, and so it was a rather rapid process of elimination, as I remember. The basic question, as often in the UN in those days, was whatever the U.S. and the Soviet Union could agree on, nobody else was going to get in the way of that. because that was such a difficult agreement, and you did require Security Council action. Therefore, you had to have both.
Right. Now, this was still in the aftermath of the Soviet proposal for a so-called Troika, which I believe at this point they had not entirely given up.
That's right. So it was part of our interest to get a solution that would knock that on the head finally. I must say that I never thought that that would fly. I thought it was just a ploy, and I think it was essentially just a ploy. I don't think they really thought that that was going to be the way. One thing, it was sort of unconstitutional under the charter. So we never, I must say, took it very seriously. There was a lot of noise about it in the paper, about much debate and editorial and so forth. But looking at it from the inside, it never looked like something on which we had to make policy. We just obviously were against it, and therefore it wasn't going to happen.
Did the United States work closely with one or more other countries at this point in trying to decide or determine who would be the next Secretary General?
There was a good deal of consultation, which was normal, with the British and French. I went back to Washington almost immediately. Because I usually just spend a day or two up there, and then I go back to my desk. So I wasn't involved in the actual canvassing of delegations. The mission was organized in such a way as that there was somebody responsible for each group for keeping in touch with each group. More or less organized by geography, and those people, of course, all fanned out and took soundings and so forth. But my recollection of it is your research would reveal how quickly the decision was made. But my recollection was that the consensus came quite fast.
Well, there was a good bit of back and forth, because the Soviets, while giving up the Troika idea, proposed that there should be an interim administration of four secretaries general. But then you may recall that quite an argument developed about how many advisors then the Secretary General should have, because even on the American side, I believe, according to the records I have, the U.S. proposed that the new Secretary General, who would be U Thant, would have a certain number of advisors who would come from the different regions of the world.
Yeah, but again, my recollection is that we were trying to stalemate the Soviet suggestions for converting the Secretariat into a committee, because all of their suggestions had that character, that sort of common characteristic. That it would make it into a collective executive, sort of like the EEC. And our mindset was that that was bad business, and that we had put a lot of emphasis. In fact, I made a number of speeches in that period about the UN's capacity to act. That in a way I was arguing with the conventional wisdom of the UN experts that well, after all, the UN's a good thing because it's a place where everybody gets to blow off steam, and it's a good talk place. And I always argued that what was important about the UN was its capacity to act independent, not independent way exactly, but in a sort of objective and a neutral and a non-sovereign way. And that was why the things that were working and that we were able to do in matters like the World Weather Watch and the arrangements for civil aviation, the arrangements for divvying up the electromagnetic frequency spectrum, and the smallpox eradication, which was started during that period, all seemed to work was because we empowered an international organization actually to do something. And that was, whereas the organizations that mostly talked had difficulty getting around to doing anything, UNESCO being the outstanding example even in those days. So, as I mentioned to Jean, this capacity to act theme ran through much of what we were then thought we were doing.
And for that purpose, you felt there was a need for a strong single secretary, John?
Yes, and with a staff that could, we needed an executive, in other words. Now, our problem in thinking about an UFAT was that we were unlikely to get a person who would be willing to take the kind of independent initiative, sort of pick up the ball and run with it in the way that Hammarskjöld was willing to do. Even UFAT was a unitary. UFAT was an improvement over some committee. So that was about where we came out on.
If I could just go back for one moment to Hammarskjöld's tenure. Hammarskjöld was an activist, certainly, and in the final stage of his career as Secretary General, I believe he enjoyed the full support of the United States. But that was not always the case. And I wondered, from your perspective as Assistant Secretary of State at that point, was it your sense that Hammarskjöld could continue along the path that he was moving, or that he perhaps had reached the limits of his capacity, given the attitude of the Soviet Union?
Well, I think as far as U.S. support was concerned, he certainly could continue. I mean, by the time I came to the picture, which of course in his life and tenure was very late, January 1961, but by that time his development of the UN's capacity to act was perceived as clearly in the U.S. interest. In the Congo, we argued with the president, and he kept remembering this in subsequent meetings, that if the UN weren't in there buffaloing the Russians, we would be. And the UN was obviously a much better mousetrap than we would be. And Now that was with that theme of empowering the UN. I used to argue, for example, that the way you would measure the success of crisis management in the UN context, from the U.S. point of view, would be that whether after each crisis the UN was stronger and better set up with a capacity to act for the next crisis, which there was bound to be somewhere in the world. We even tried to get some regular arrangements for earmarking forces and facilities and so forth that would be made available to the UN upon request. The Joint Chiefs of Staff didn't like that idea very much. But we had very good support for the general proposition on peacekeeping and for the UN being in the picture on West New Guinea, for example, later on, and even on the Dominican Republic, where the Latin Americanists in the department and the folks in the White House were sort of appalled at our notion that Stevenson and I came up with, that there should be a UN person also involved in the Dominican Republic affair, a UN observer. And also, of course, we argued, although it wasn't our jurisdiction, that the OAS should be involved. So I don't think there was ever any serious thought that we would go for any kind of committifying of the and our putting up kind of a straw man on, well, you know, if you're going to have advisors, you got to have a strong American advisor, was really just a straw man. Mm.
In the end, I think all Eutan said was that he was going to invite a limited number of persons to serve as his senior advisors, and he specifically listed Ralph Bunche and a Russian named Arkadyev. This presumably was quite satisfactory to the American side.
Ralph Bunche was already I guess he was already there when they.
Oh yes, night. Very much, yeah. Very much.
And had been for years.
He'd been there since Trigley Lee.
So that wasn't an outside advisor.
No.
And Arkadyev was just the ranking Soviet in the secretariat.
That's right. So that's actually the way Eutan got out of this particular problem.
It was very Burmese.
Right. But I had asked the other question because, in fact, I wanted to move ahead and ask you, based on this experience and your rather intimate observation of the operation of the United Nations since then and even before, is this the right way to select a Secretary General by negotiation, so to speak, by finding the man who is or woman who is most acceptable to the most number of countries? Do you see this as a weakness of the system, or can you suggest something better?
Well, I think it's inherent in the structure. If you decide to have an international organization that is a committee of sovereigns with a staff, you're stuck with the sovereigns on the appointment. Now, in many ways, I've always regarded the Treaty of Rome as a as a brilliant departure from the Committee of Sovereigns with a Staff sort of thing. It was one of Monet's most interesting inventions. I mean, you have, first of all, the people are appointed by their governments, but they can't be removed by, except by unanimous consent, which would never happen. They are political level people, as members of this collective executive. They're typically ex-cabinet ministers, even sometimes sitting cabinet ministers who are assigned. They have a lot of jurisdiction. They have a monopoly of certain subjects that are laid down in the treaty that are European subjects. They have the capacity to consult publicly. Labor, agriculture, the media, and now a directly elected parliament. And then in the last moment, they do have to go to the Committee of Sovereigns. But the Treaty of Rome has this wonderful gimmick in it that says the Committee of Sovereigns can't edit. It can only say yes or no. But it can't say, we don't like paragraph 8, and we're going to rewrite it this way. So the Commission has the ball, and gradually, over quite a number of years, I think in a way for it to realize that it had the ball, but it really has it has the ball tucked well under its arm now. In fact, you hear, nowadays, you hear people in Europe complaining that the European Commission is a new form of dictatorship and so forth.
Whereas in the case of the United Nations, you've heard no such complaints since Hammarskjöld.
Not since Hammarskjöld, no. Mm-hmm. And there are some situations in which if you have a strong enough person, a committee of sovereigns with a staff can really act like an executive agency. I think that's been true of the World Bank and the IMF, by and large, which have had strong leadership, strong executive leadership. But it's not the norm. It has not been the norm in UNESCO, FAO, most of the agencies. It has been the norm, interestingly enough, in the UN Environmental Program, maybe because it isn't a specialized agency, exactly. I mean, the degree of initiative that Tolba and his staff have been able to take on things like the Mediterranean cleanup and the Ozone Treaty more recently is very impressive. We, in fact, this American Assembly we were just at, I wrote a paragraph to patting UNEP on the head, which got through by acclamation.
That's surprising, because there is not such a generally positive assessment of UNEP, I think.
Well, it's got all the problems of the bureaucracy, and besides it's in Nairobi, so nobody really knows very much how it works. So. But in fact, they have done, they have served as catalyst and gadfly and innovator, demonstrating a capacity to act. I go back to that old theme. I still think that that's the right theme, and that that's the way an international organization ought to be judged.
Right. Now, with Mr. Utant, or you can't say Mr. Utant, with Utant in office, a fate brought the United States and him together on a number of issues, the outcome of which were controversial from the U.S. perspective, I think. One of them was Vietnam, which I don't propose to discuss, but the other was Cuba and the Cuban missile crisis. I wonder if you would just describe how you saw that situation develop from the perspective of the State Department, beginning really with the Bay of Pigs, because that was an issue at the United Nations, which the United States representative had to handle. And there were problems, if I am not mistaken. Could you describe that a little bit?
Well, there was a recurring Cuban item on the General Assembly agenda, in which in various ways and with new evidence each time the Cubans would accuse us of being about to invade them. And there was, and such an item was due for debate in the General Assembly on the day the CIA invaded Cuba. A brilliant piece of timing, we always thought, on the part of the CIA. We were not terribly well briefed. Tracy Barnes came up the week before, and I went up with him, and Arthur Schlesinger did. And Adelaide was briefed, and then we all talked about it. And we didn't like it very much, but on the other hand, they were assuring us that these were really freedom fighters, that and they didn't tell us anything like anything nearly all the truth about the degree to which the whole thing was straight CIA operation. So Adlai, I think, was always uncomfortable with it, but he wasn't going out in the streets and opposing it or anything. So the first thing that happened, where it got thrown into the UN, was that on the day that Cuban item was starting, Adlai was on the floor of the General Assembly anyway. A pilot flying a plane with Cuban markings landed in a swamp in Florida and announced that he had defected. It later turned out that this was a pilot who had flown from Nicaragua and back. It was a big splash in the media, and so of course we wanted to know right away in our bureau what was going on, so we could tell Stevenson what he could say, because there he was on the floor of the General Assembly, and everybody else was listening to the same radio and reading the same newspaper. So I got hold of the Latin American Bureau, and the Latin American Bureau got hold of the CIA, and they came back with this story that, yes, indeed, it was a defector and so on. Well, within less than 20, and we authorized Stevenson to say that, he said it, he then compounded the error, his alert staff saw the same story coming out of Florida in the what the pilot had said, so they tear the thing off the AP ticker and rush it into Stevenson, and he says, well, I just have confirmation here about this, you see. So he reads the same cover story over again. In less than 24 hours, some enterprising newspaper man scratched the side of the airplane and found U.S. Air Force markings underneath. And so the cover blew off, and Adlai was absolutely fit to be tied. He was a rather mild person, really, and tolerant, but he was just furious that that his government could have hung him out to dry that way. And he was very nice about not blaming me for it. I was the proximate authorizer of that mistake, of that lie. We already had a rather sour taste in our mouth about Cuba. Although it's not really part of your inquiry here, to me it's always been an interesting contrast. That happened in April of the year of 61, which was the year that Kennedy started.
Right.
Kennedy had never been an executive. The last executive job that John F. Kennedy had before he took over as president was to be head of a PT boat. And he didn't know about it. I later asked one of the Joint Chiefs of Staff how it had happened that they had never told the president that from a military point of view, this operation